Chromosomes. Little strands of nucleic acids and proteins are the fundamental genetic instructions that tell us who we are at birth. Most people are born with 46 chromosomes, but each year in the United States, about 6,000 people are born with an extra chromosome, making them a person with Down syndrome. If you've ever encountered someone with Down syndrome, you know that they are some of the kindest, most joyful people you will ever meet. They truly have something extra. My name is Lisa Nichols, and for 30 years, I have been both the CEO of Technology Partners and the mother to Allie. Allie has something extra in every sense of the word. I have been blessed to be by her side as she impacts everyone she meets. Through these two important roles as CEO and mother to Allie, I have witnessed countless life lessons that have fundamentally changed the way I look at the world. While you may not have an extra chromosome, every leader has something extra that defines who you are. Join me as I explore the something extra in leaders from all walks of life and discover how that difference in each of them has made a difference in their companies, their families, their communities, and in themselves. If you like this episode today, please go to Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen and leave us a 5-star rating. Before we get started, I'm excited to share that my book, Something Extra, is now available. It is rooted in the remarkable spirit of our daughter, Allie, and the heartfelt conversations we've had on the podcast. You'll find wisdom and practical tools to ignite the leader within you and uncover your own Something Extra. Visit somethingextrabook.com or find it at Amazon or in all major bookstores to order your copy today. I am honored to have Greg Boss Wooldridge on the show today. Greg is a retired U.S. Naval officer and the 3-time flight leader of the Blue Angels. Well, Greg Boss Wooldridge, welcome to the Something Extra podcast. I am so delighted to have you on the show today.
I'm really glad to be here, Lisa. This is a treat.
It's a treat for me, too. I always typically go back and tell my listeners how I meet people, and this was just a really cool one. One day, I'm on LinkedIn, and I see stuff about you, and I'm like, I'm just going to reach out to him and see if he'll be on the podcast, because I told you I've heard John Foley speak before at a CIO summit, and I'm just so fascinated by, we'll talk about it, but by the Blue Angels and aviation and that, and I thought, you know, I wonder if he would come on the podcast, and you responded right back to me, so thank you so much. Then we got on a phone, Greg. How many people did we know?
We both have dear friends, the same dear friends. I think we all have dear friends, but the same dear friends. Wonderful.
I know. So who knew, you know? So I'm just, there's going to be so much here that I want to talk about today, but I just want to read something real quickly before we jump into things, because I think this will set us up. Captain Greg Wooldridge served in the United States Navy for 27 years. During the final decade of his career, he proudly served on 3 occasions as the flight leader and commanding officer of the Navy Flight Demonstration Squadron, the Blue Angels. In addition to leading the team for hundreds of air shows in the United States, Wooldridge took the team to various locations in Europe, including Moscow, Bucharest, and Plovdiv, Bulgaria. Greg, this is so interesting to me, but you grew up not too far from me. Now, you live in Oregon now, but you grew up in Springfield, Illinois.
That's my high school graduation. It was Springfield High School. And then I commuted. Well, I didn't commute first year. I lived on campus 40 miles down to the southwest at Blackburn. I graduated from Blackburn University down between Springfield and St. Louis. So I've got my roots are in the Midwest, and that's where I claim home, even though after college, it was, you know, off and running in the Navy around the world and all over the States. So,
Right. Well, that's good. And sometimes you get back here because you do have good friends here. And we just happen to share some of those friends. But what I want to ask you about is, well, I've got lots of things to ask you about, but what were some of those values, Greg, that were instilled in you at an early age that you've carried forward with you in your naval career?
Well, I think I learned that performance creates growth, right? And how well you do at things. My dad was raised in an orphanage all the way through high school. I mean, he never lived in a family, lived in an orphanage. So he learned some incredible values, truth being foremost in his mind. And the belt came out every once in a while if there was a little a little fib or something, you know.
A little bit of white lie.
Yeah, yeah. So I learned about truth. I learned about trust. And those things from my dad were great. And then I was, you know, kind of a slacker academically. I mean, I think I had it in me. I just was lazy, you know, all the way up into mm-hmm. college. Went to a college there in Central Illinois, Blackburn, where they had a work study program. So to live on campus, you had to do a job. I actually took care of the heating and air conditioning for the campus. And I learned from that, you know, learned about responsibility and how you live up to the expectations. And that creates in you accountability and responsibility. I know a lot of those standard words that are thrown around, but you learn how you learn them and how you live with them and how you let them bring you growth. And that's, mm-hmm. that's I think, where I got a lot of the things that I can count as blessings in my life.
Right. Well, yeah, I knew that you were in charge of firing up the boiler.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say boilers because that makes me look like, well, even they were coal-fired furnaces that were left over. I won't say that I was that old, but they were left over from, you know, earlier years. And I would get up at 4 a.m. and go fire up the big furnaces and get what they call clinkers, the burned up coal. Mm-hmm. Got a few scars, burn scars, get the old coal and then fill the hopper that feeds the furnace with the fresh coal. Anyway, I learned a lot about living up to expectations.
Yeah. Yeah. And if you had not have done that, you know, then people would have been cold.
That's
right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you this. Did you always know that you wanted to fly? I mean, did you dream of flying as a little boy?
I hate to burst bubbles with that. But when I grew up in my younger years in Cincinnati, and one of the things I used to do, back in the day, I'd catch a bus from out in Westwood down to downtown Cincinnati. I was probably 10 or 11 back when kids could travel. I mean, everything mm-hmm. pretty much safer, you know. And mm-hmm. I would go to the Carew Tower, which was the tallest building in Cincinnati. And you could go up on the top, and I would sneak up my little balsa wood airplanes, put them together up there and fly them off the top of the building, you know.
Oh, I love that.
They weren't drones. They didn't have that kid, you know, but they, right. So that was my experience with flying and making models and things like that, plastic models. I can't remember the name of the Revell, I think, made a lot of those models.
Revell. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then at a very young age. And then after that, it was like, well, what am I going to do in life? I thought about forestry and, you know, I love the outdoors and, I never really got refocused on aviation. So here's how I got to it. I got into college. While I was in college, I did a college kid dumb thing, and I had a child and got married. So now, in those days, coming out of college, I needed to be able to find work immediately, right? And learn a skill. And I got a basic Bachelor of Arts degree with an economics major. That was about as specific as you could get, economics, you know, macro, micro, whatever. And that wasn't a real big honor to carry out. But in those days, when you finished your college, where you had a deferral from the draft, it was time to serve. I thought, okay, mm-hmm. I don't have a problem with that. I'd love to serve my country. And the way I found to get to, it got me to aviation was I needed to learn a skill. Now I've got a college degree. I'll go into one of the services and learn how to fly. So when I get out, I can get an airline job.
Yeah.
So that was my motivation to get into flying. You know, no stars in the eyes, no looking up saying, that's what I want to do, you know. So graduated from college finally, and was off to the Navy to do the most demanding flying in the world off of aircraft carriers. So that's how I got.
Yes. Well, several things that you just said what you did in college, but listen, you had the blessing of a baby, right? Yeah. It could have been so much, it could have been something different, right, Greg? But, you know, that's...
Fine young, I say young man, you know, fine man.
Yes. Okay, so I know, I think this is true. Correct me if I'm wrong. Some things that I read, I think your call sign was Rug Dance.
Well, I didn't like it, so it stuck like glue. If you get, get labeled with something, either by the way you look or your actions or part of your, something that sounded like your name, you know, that could be laid into your name, like a good friend of mine. Okay, yeah, Rug Dance. And I'll tell you what that means in a second. But a good friend of mine, I'll give you a couple examples. His name was Scott Swift. He became the 4-star admiral in charge of the whole Pacific warfare. Groups, you know, Navy, Army, everybody. So Scott Swift, his call sign was Not So Swift. And so here's this 4-star admiral, and I still called him Not So, you know, Not So Swift. And then another fellow named Jim Ward, his call sign was Psycho Ward. And then you had young men that had different appearances, and my call sign Rug Dance came from being called on the carpet too much, being screwing up, and pressing the envelope, maybe exceed going outside the envelope of legality, and stand in front of the boss's desk, the CEO's, the commanding officer's desk, in a cart. Usually, they called it the carpet. And shuffling my feet, and that was called a rug dance. And I did
the rug dance.
Yeah. So I was glad I got to the Blues where they took away your fleet call sign and called you boss.
Boss. Yes. So I know that was your call sign when you got there. You know, when I was reading, because I read some things, Greg, about you pushing the envelope, and I was thinking, Maverick. You're like a Tom Cruise Maverick pushing the envelope.
Little bit of that, you might say, but always considering the impact on others. That's one thing that has formed me a little bit, that accountability to other people.
Yeah, for sure. Well, let's get into it. So the selection process, I know, is very, very rigorous. Mm-hmm. What do you remember about the day that you found out you were chosen? Wasn't there a number or something that you were supposed to call into?
Oh, that was Amanda. That's the story of Amanda.
That's Amanda. Yeah.
And the team did that with the junior officers. They would tease them, make you feel like you didn't get selected. And then they'd say, well, you know, then they, on a conference call on a phone, they'd say, welcome to the team. And they'd give, you know, say your call sign or whatever. For me, for the boss job, it was a different selection process. We interviewed with some ex Blue Angel bosses, some flag officers, admirals, Navy captains, and senior officers, and they interviewed you and interviewed the finalists for the boss job. And there were about 6 of us, Corpus Christi, and they let me know after all the interviews were over, and they deliberated for a couple of hours, and then they came and said, we've selected you. You're the guy for the job. And I really didn't think that would happen. One of the reasons why I think I was so comfortable in that environment was because when I got there, I saw the competition for the new boss position, which included the commanding officer of Top Gun, another guy that had been doing aerial demonstrations on the East Coast, very handsome, blonde hair, you know, flowing blonde hair. He just looked like the picture perfect person for the job. So I was very relaxed. And I just said, I'm just going to tell them what it is, you know, like it is. I'm going to be myself. Yeah. And if I get it, I'm not going to get it. They're not going to pick me. But that's all.
Well, that's question one. That's probably one of the reasons they did pick you, is because that you were humble and you you weren't arrogant and all of that, right?
Well, one of the guys on the board, Chris Konzi, I'll never forget the man. He was a Hungarian refugee, but a Navy captain. He had seen the bad times in Hungary, but he said to me, one of the reasons you got selected is because we saw you go over to the communications center to find out about how you were troops, because I was commanding a squadron on a ship in Japan. And they say, we saw you go over there to check on your troops and see how they were doing in the promotion boards and in the selection boards, advancement boards. And they said amongst themselves, they said, no, there's a guy that cares about his people. And that was a big factor.
I love that. I love that. Thank you for sharing that with me. Well, this is probably, I'm just going to repeat this, but you're the only person in history to lead the Blue Angels 3 times. That's incredible. So I'm sure that is one of the reasons that they picked you, is because they knew that you really cared about your people. Are there other things you think, Greg, that they kept coming back to you and picking you for that?
Some of it, frankly, Lisa, was timing and availability. And of course, I was willing to come back. The first time I got called back, I didn't particularly like the reason that they had set that boss, the guy that relieved me, they set him aside. So that was a bit of a rub for me, but I had only been gone for 6 months. So coming back was fairly, I would say easy, but, workable. And then the second time I got called back, I hadn't flown for 2.5 years. And the team had a confidence issue, a morale issue in leadership. And so that was a bit of a challenge. And I was getting ready to retire. But I was the guy that they needed to get there, right? And somebody that could step into a troubled environment and bring things right again.
Okay. Well, good. I'm glad you shared that with me. So tell me, what did you do when you came in? I mean, because that relates to business, right? There's so many organizations that have a troubled environment. So what were some of those first things you did, Greg, when you came into the squadron after you that second time?
I think to elicit trust and self-confidence in each member. There were about 150 people in the squadron, and I talked to each person personally about how we were going to get this done, because there was a lot of doubt. The skill level was still there, extremely high, but the doubt, the lack of confidence in what the leadership was doing. So I shared with them that I'm gonna give you 150%, and I just ask that you give me your best, and we can get this done. We're gonna go out and we're gonna knock it out of the park again, right? And I'm just here for you. So you let me know what's on your mind and where you think we can go from here. And I just ask for your best performance, and I'm here for you.
I love that. Single
person, right? In a major corporation of thousands, you're going to have to get to the lowest possible level that you can, do time-wise and talk with folks and let them know who you are. Project that, what I hope is real humility, but have confidence, but also allow yourself to show vulnerability, because there's strength in being vulnerable and being able to share that, I screwed that up,
Right.
To fix it. So anyway, that's a long answer. Sorry.
That's really good. Well, Greg, I mean, with the Blue Angels, and this still, I told you, this blows me away. And I know that you get even lower than that by the end, but flying that 18 inches apart, I mean, that just blows me away. There's a tremendous amount of trust there between the pilots, right? And you said at the end, the goal is to get down to 12 inches apart. Not all the squadrons make it to that. But what do you think? I mean, we're talking to execute. There has got to be so much precision and trust. I mean, what's the hardest thing about leading a team that has to be that precise? I mean, there's really no room for mistakes.
Yeah. Well, the hardest thing is quite frankly made simple by the way we operated. And that was, when we got done flying, we would sit around the table, and that sounds informal, but it's structured, a long table, and we were on the road 35 weeks out of the year, so the environment itself changed a little bit, but the structure of how we got into this debrief, and we talked about what had happened, That's how we generated incredible trust, because it started with me, the person that was in charge, the CEO, you know, I would, or the project manager, whatever it was, if you were debriefing. In our case, it was a practice or an air show. And practices were the same as air shows as far as their intensity of debrief. And so I'd get in there and talk about what I had done and what I could have done better, what my mistakes were. We call them safeties. And everything that you could think of that you had done wrong, you put it out there and say, look, this is what I did wrong. And that was what I call strength and vulnerability. And the reason was that you'd say you'd fix it, and then it would go to the next person. And we built that into the culture, that accountability, that you're able to say exactly what you did wrong and give assurances that I recognize it and I'm not going to let it happen again. If you couldn't figure it out, then we went into this mentoring mode, which was not caustic. It was not critical. It was not sharp. It was, you know, with love, because we loved what we did. We loved our team, and we fired it up and got ready. So at the end of the debrief, now you had things that you had complimented each other on, you know, the praise that comes from doing well, and that was great. But you'd also discovered, and that enabled you to do better the next time and increase performance. But we also discovered what had challenged us and how we were going to keep working to fix that. You know, as Vince Lombardi once said, Vince Lombardi, a lot of the young folks don't know, the greatest of all time coach of the Green Bay Packers, in paraphrase, he would say, we're going to go out today and we're going to seek perfection. We are going to work to get perfection, but we'll never get there. But along the way, we are going to experience excellence. And that's what we were shooting for in the Blues. And that's what made us different, that being vulnerable, allowing to be vulnerable, expectations of that, revealing everything that you had done wrong. And if you couldn't remember it, somebody would help you along the way in a very positive way. So that strength and vulnerability, that was what really unusual. And nobody had to hold back, because it was the culture of being, you know, responsible and accountable. And that was okay. That was encouraged.
I love it. I love it. Oh, there's so much goodness in that, because being able to take the feedback, without the feedback, how can you improve, right? You can improve. And so I even, when I speak to younger people, I'm like, be open to feedback, ask for feedback,
right?
Ask for feedback. Say, what could I do better? You observed me in that meeting. What could I do better? I think that's so important. You know, one other thing I'm just thinking about, Greg, is when I heard John Foley speak, you guys had a line that you would say, glad to be here. And I was thinking about it this morning. I was thinking, what a positive, that's a positive demeanor to have too, right? And just be grateful that we're here. And, you know, what did that, like even saying that line, I mean, what kind of, I don't know, what kind of emotions did that build in the team?
It was an expression that allowed you to level out. Let's say you'd had a terrible day flying, you were out of position, you couldn't make your maneuvers work. You talk about it, express it. There was no fear. So fear is dissolved in that debrief environment. Now you're on edge and you're not fearful, but you're aware in flight with these challenges. But once you get into debrief, there's no fear of being open. So you can say everything that you had done, you can express that in a fear-free environment. The end of whatever you did, if you had a terrible day, you could say glad to be here, because I'm feeling the trust that we have amongst each other. And when I talk about the culture of the Blue Angels, I talk about the two factors that built the culture. And one was trust. And because the trust was so strong, you were glad to be there. The trust and the gratitude work together. So being trustworthy, you know, talk about a leader, you have to be trustworthy, right? And that involves a lot of things. Some words that I usually talk about, but you've got that trust built in. And so that builds that glad to be here. And the glad to be here helps us remind each other. You know, I've even got a sticker of that on the back of my cell phone, my iPhone, that, you know what, despite how hard it is, despite the day you may have had, you're allowed to talk about that. And that, you know, that lets you relax and become grateful, you know, the gratefulness of that, and the glad to be here is a reset.
Yeah, so good. So good. Well, Greg, I've got lots more questions, but we need to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Greg Wooldridge on the Something Extra podcast.
In business, the tendency is to seek out partners who are bigger, faster, stronger. When it comes to IT, you should be looking for smarter, faster, better. That's just what you'll find with the talented technologists at Technology Partners. Our experts develop custom solutions to tackle your most complex challenges, all to simplify your processes in the smartest, most efficient way possible. The time to be swift and nimble starts now. Go to technologypartners.net/solutions and see what's possible.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Something Extra podcast with Greg Boss Wooldridge. We've been having a lot of fun talking about Blue Angels and all kinds of other things. But, you know, Greg, you have said a team's mission was bigger than just air shows. Right. How did you keep that bigger why in front of your squadron?
Yeah. It was about building relationships with people, all right? The people that got to see you, the people that heard about you. You're ambassadors of goodwill, and you're out working with the public all the time. And I'll digress for just a second. That is part of the reason why we didn't pick replacement pilots, and we got to pick our own, which is pretty cool, but we didn't pick them based on military records and flying performance. It was about personality, because that's where we needed that humility, the ability to connect, be accountable, and be humble at the same time. Be confident, but be humble. So we got to interact with a whole bunch of cool people. One of the things I think you'll enjoy is that appreciate is that we worked with Make-A-Wish. And we would ask, especially in the major markets that we went to, we'd ask for the local chapter to bring the kids out. And the kids would be so wonderful to be with. And we'd have them come out on a Thursday when we first arrived, when there's no crowds. And we'd actually bring them out to the flight line. I actually took some of my Make-A-Wish kids and put them in the jet, put them in my seat in my cockpit, which doesn't happen very often, and give them a special, very special experience because they deserve it. And it's part of, you know, I found out in the Bay Area from the chair lady there that it's not about granting a wish because something bad was going to happen. It was about granting a wish for life, you know, to have an experience that would bring people to a higher appreciation for living and share something with them. And many times the Make-A-Wish kids, fortunately, it's a blessing they recover. One of the essential parts of that was to know that there's people out there, the Make-A-Wish kids, the challenged kids like Allie, and that, you know, we have it easy compared to they're the rock stars. They're the superheroes out there. It's just us flying around in the blue jets with the great support and everything, but the kids that woke up in the morning that maybe didn't know what was going to happen that day, right? So it was great for keeping us humble. So.
Yes. It's so beautiful. So beautiful. Well, let's talk a little bit about leadership and high performance teams. So what do you think? And we've already talked about some of these things, and I definitely think humility is the first chapter in my book, by the way, Greg, because it's so important. But what do you think separates a good leader from a great one? What are some of those characteristics?
How many books have been written on leadership? Right? How many times have words been repeated? I would say for me, to build a trust environment is crucial. And you do it through your personal integrity. I use four C's with trust. One is competence, that you're competent in what you're doing. You don't have to be the greatest that ever lived, or you don't have to be on that pinnacle, but you should be competent, and that starts building trust. And then it is about your character, and character is terribly important, wonderfully important.
Yes.
And part of that is being truthful. Truth is a big part of character. And the fourth C that I like to talk about is commitment. Commitment to let's make our mission happen and do it
yes.
in the best possible way. And then you got to trust going back and forth with your teammates. And the fourth one is consistency. A good leader has to be consistent. And once you, if you ever break that, be ready. Be ready for some doubts to arise and your effectiveness to shrink a little bit. Consistency. Now, all of that also leads to that, what I talked about, allowing you to be vulnerable. So you've earned the trust, and now you can be vulnerable and be unafraid. I've dealt with some corporations where that environment didn't exist. And there were people that would never say anything, first of all, because they were fearful. So the fear has got to be erased. They were fearful. And others, there's cultural issues where, because of who they were, they weren't supposed to say anything. Yeah, but the fear is the big thing. And we drove that out, and that's what a leader will do. He'll make sure that there's no fear, because you're not going to get to the right answers about things and move forward positively without being able to hear from everyone. I see companies where they have in their midst silent geniuses, people that make the difference in that organization, but they're fearful. They're afraid to say anything, or they don't have the opportunity. The structure, the culture doesn't encourage that. These are the mistakes I made, and I think we can all get better. I took that debrief to FedEx when I was flying with them, and
yes.
We experienced some growth there with using that way of talking about things without being afraid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So talk about that. You spent what, 16 years at FedEx?
No, about active years, about 13. And then I had, then I had an event where I had a wonderful second chance, and I lived through cardiac arrest. And then I had to go, had to kind of quit flying after that. But I survived something that's about an 80% chance, sudden cardiac death is what they usually call it. So I survived. Second chance was there. But I did get to, wonderfully, after retiring from the Navy, I got to fly with FedEx.
Yes, which is another iconic company.
And, God bless Fred Smith, who just recently passed. What an incredible man. Did some great things and created a wonderful company, and they were great to work for.
Mm-hmm.
We had a great safety record there after I got, in their past, wonderful safety record. Then they started having things happen, landing gear collapse or something, where the airplane would be damaged. And they said, well, why is this happening? And I said, well, they asked us, I was in a very minor leadership or managerial position as an instructor. And I thought about it. Why is this happening? There's nothing common in what's happening here. One was landing, one's a takeoff, one's something in flight. They're not the same type of.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at it, and I went home, thought about it. And I said, one thing we never do, we never talk about the flight we just got off of. Primarily, I think, because a lot of it was overnight freight, overnight mail and mission, where you would get into someplace like Orlando at 4 or 5 in the morning, just, and now you were working in the nighttime and sleeping in the daytime. The only thing you wanted to talk about was get to the hotel and not even talk about it, just get there and pull the blinds shut, pretend like it's nighttime and try to get some sleep.
Sure.
And I remember laying my head down on the pillow a couple times going, well, there's something odd about that flight, and there was something cool about that flight, you know, or there's something good about it. I'd like to talk about that. But there was really no procedure, no vehicle to do that. So I went back and I said, look, folks, if we could only debrief what had happened. I said, at Blue Angels, our debriefs were about an hour to an hour and a half long. Immediately they go, oh, yeah, that can't happen. I said, no, but here's what we can do. You know, we don't need to do that. We can spend 30 seconds, 2 minutes, whatever it takes to flesh out the good things on the flight and the not so good things on the flight. And we can grow and get better because we can diminish the things that are not good. Mm-hmm. And embellish and bring into light the things that we did well. And the captain of the ship, the captain of the pilot would say, all right, and before you left the cockpit, we put it on the checklist and the FAA approved it. You'd say, okay, let's debrief. And the captain would say, and so I thought it was a pretty good flight. I missed a turn on the taxiway, or you know, I was a little off on altitude here, but I can fix those things. So yeah, it gets out in the air, you know, and then the first officer and back in way back, they had a second officer, an engineer. Everybody had a chance to talk and discuss what had happened on that flight and how we could grow from it. And there was no fear. There was full accountability. And again, that vulnerability. So that's how the Glad to Be Here debrief got into
to FedEx.
Take it from the Blue Angels.
Yeah, take it from the Blue Angels. Well, I'll never forget Greg having a Top Gun instructor on the podcast early on. Cujo Teschner is his name, Robert Teschner. Mm-hmm. And he discussed the whole thing about plan, execute, debrief. Mm-hmm. Plan, execute, debrief. And so I just think taking that into your business, I think is really, really important after a sales call.
Right.
After you've delivered a system, whatever the case may be, really taking a look and taking the time, because otherwise, you know, you may repeat the same mistake over and over and over, and that's insanity, right?
That's right. It doesn't. That's what they say. And then you don't grow from it. You don't get better if you.
That's right.
If things are hidden,
yeah,
you're not good.
Yeah. Well, let's go back because you talked about your cardiac event, and I knew about that, but you know, didn't you have an inverted spin?
Oh, yeah.
When you were flying, that almost was not a good outcome.
It was the way I got into that inverted spin, according to the flight manuals, was a guarantor that you weren't going to recover. You know, that meant either up and out, which means ejecting.
Right.
We always just say you're going to have to jump now, which meant eject. Use your parachute.
Yes.
I got the airplane in through my aggressiveness and my rug dance behavior. I got outside the envelope of the airplane. I was dogfighting with another guy. We both got our nose pitched straight up. And I watched him fall off, and that's when you, in the normal dogfighting world, you'd be able to roll in behind him. You get behind somebody, you have a tentative, you have a weapons solution, right? So you win that fight.
Mm-hmm.
So I got up there, we got up really high in these A4s, and I watched him roll off. I got him now. And I tried to move the controls. The airplane wouldn't do anything. And I thought, no, in the flight manual it said don't ever get the nose of the airplane straight up or even beyond straight up, 100 degrees nose up at zero airspeed, because you'll get into an inverted spin. So with the tail flying back and you're on your back and you're going around in circles, not circles, but in a rotation. And it said in the flight manual there is no known recovery. So in most places where you get into an environment in an airplane that is unfamiliar or is not where you want to be, there is a recovery process, right? And it put the controls into the spin or away from the spin, the rudder, do all these things, you know. No known recovery for inverted spin. So we started sliding. I had a two-seater in the kind of my back seat. We started tail sliding back and then got into that inverted spin. We watched the altitude decrease further and further. Now, when you're in a spin, you don't have airflow across the flight control, so you don't have airflow across the canopy, and there's a different sound, right, when you just kind of quietly turning like that. Watch the altitude drop and drop and drop. We got to the altitude where we should have ejected and didn't. And that was my call, with concurrence with the fellow in the back seat. And then we got to the altitude where it would have been futile to eject. We're too low. Mm-hmm. Finally, at less than 5,000 feet, way less than that off the water, finally I could hear the wind coming by the canopy. So that meant there's probably wind over the flight control. So I started trying, and I was able to roll the airplane right side up and fly it away, scooped out, I think, around maybe 500 feet off the water. And started heading back to land. And one of the funny things, now it's funny, was that as I added power to fly back toward the coast of California, I looked up at the instruments and there was zero oil pressure, which means the engine's going to rub itself to death, without oil.
Mm-hmm.
And wear itself down. And I told the guy in the back, hey, good news, bad news. We are heading back. Bad news is there's no oil in the engine. And what had happened was because of that upside down flight, the oil had gone back into the tank. It would cavitate it away from the engine. It was still there.
Mm-hmm.
A while for it to get pumped back into the system, and it finally came back. But it was kind of like, well, we did it, but we're still going to have to go swimming, maybe.
Yeah. So did you? Did you have to go swimming?
No, we made it. We made it back.
You made it. Wow.
Anyway, things like that. Second chances have been on my life.
Radar.
Yeah.
On your life.
Yeah.
Well, did it inform faith at all?
It did. Absolutely.
What did it do with your faith?
Well, see, that's another thing, Lisa. I had a belief, but I didn't have what we call a relationship with the mm-hmm. Lord, right? And so I thought, well, I lucked out there. I lucked out here. I lucked out with the heart thing. But after the cardiac arrest is when I really started wondering, about what happens and what happens when you pass. And where does all this energy go? Our energy, you almost can't see it in our thoughts. Our thoughts are out there. Where does it go? What happens? Where do we wind up?
So you started asking the questions.
I started asking the questions. It took me a long time to find out. Too long. But once I found out, that's when I realized those things that I called luck were really blessings. And
were God's hand on you?
Yes, absolutely.
He was sparing you. But wow. Mm-mm-mm. Well, let me ask you a question. Since that realization, mm-hmm. how do you think you've been transformed?
Mm.
What kind of transformations happened?
One thing that's happened, and there's been tons of things, but one of the things that I notice every day, and it's being judgmental. I fight that all the time, because I know we're all created in the image of God, right? And you can't judge people because you don't know what their life is like.
Right.
The things that they're facing, right? And mm-hmm. you make a judgment and all of a sudden, most of the time you realize, well, that was not right.
Completely wrong, right?
And our Lord teaches us that, judge not lest ye be judged, right? Think about it. And then just loving everybody, and smiling. Mm-hmm. And our society, our culture is so downtrodden now that it's,
mm-hmm.
if more of us could say, approach life and people with love and let that play out, right? And it brings out the best in others. A lot of times you see somebody that's really downtrodden and frowning and unhappy, even people you meet in a store, the clerks or whatever, and you just say, hey, how's it going? You look kind of beat up. Are you doing okay? And smile.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you don't have to be quite that personal unless you feel like it's the time, right?
Right. Right. But that smile, that just that
kind gesture, that kind reach out. I mean, Greg, it can change the trajectory of someone's life. You know, it can change their day for sure. Yeah.
One of the things I do, Lisa, when I talk about what builds a team, a lot of it has to do with respect. So you approach people with respect. Mm-hmm. I like to tell the little story of walking through an airport and seeing, you know, we're just passing face to face with people. And just, you know, I got to get to the gate, and, you know, and I'm not real happy about flying and blah, 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 blah. I take a look around and I notice how clean and beautiful the place is, right? And I'll look to see who's involved with that. I may see somebody cleaning the walls or sweeping the floor or pushing the carts, you know. And if it's a clean and wonderful environment, which we don't take notice of often enough, excuse me, I'll say to them, hey, this place is beautiful. Great job. Thank you.
Yes.
And that little bit of interaction, that little bit of respect, boy, it takes you 3 or 4 seconds to do it. But what do you think? How do you think call it a menial job, call those people invisible because they are invisible to most of us. And what that does, oh my goodness, can you imagine? Mm-hmm. Well, maybe my job doesn't stink as bad as I think it does, right?
Right.
I'm appreciated. There's an appreciation and respect. So that's another thing that
I love that. Very practical thing that we can do, but it's opening our eyes to see those, right? It's opening our eyes, getting outside of ourselves. And
if more people could do that too, the world would change.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt about it. Well, I want to talk about this real fast because I really want our listeners to go and do this. So you were a co-producer for the Blue Angels documentary that came out in 2024. I told you that our family sat down and watched it, and it is so, so good, Greg. But why do you think telling that story is so important? You know, because, I mean, it's special.
Yeah, about 5 years, well, 2019, before the pandemic, I had the idea to make another documentary about something that was good and true and all American, right? And showed American exceptionalism. And I thought, there's nothing finer than the Blue Angels and what we do and what we demonstrate. So I called Rob Stone, a good friend of mine who had made an award-winning documentary on the Blues before about my team that went to Russia. And I said, Rob, it's time to do it again. And we got through it. We got through the pandemic where we lost support, but then gained it through Glenn Powell and J.J. Abrams and some of those folks, and got the movie out May of last year. Mm-hmm. But it was so important for me, to get that done, because it really shows how you can go beyond your own self-imposed limitations to do extraordinary things. And once you get to be doing, once you have the chance to do them, you don't even look at them as extraordinary anymore. You look at those things as a way of life, and you're able to share with others. And I think it was important to see that on screen. You know, I wanted to make sure it was G-rated so kids could grow from it and learn from it. But adults love it too. So yeah, it was just important to me. And the beautiful thing was, Brian Kesselring was the boss on that team that you saw in the movie. Yes. He was in his third year because of the holdover from the non-air show year of the pandemic. And he was terrific. So between a wonderful production team and the wonderful Blue Angel team, I kind of built those bonds and that trust. Mm-hmm. Back to the good T word, the trust. Mm-hmm. We got it done. It was just important to do it.
So good. I encourage our listeners to go watch it. It's in IMAXs.
Well,
but you can also see it on Amazon Prime, right?
The only place you can see it in IMAX now is in museums, because in January this year, IMAX made a 40-minute version instead of a feature length like it's on Prime. But it's in IMAX, the way it was filmed. And I've been promoting it. I went to Kennedy Space Center and the Air and Space Museum with showings of the movie. So it's a great way. But that's just to tell you that IMAX is a wonderful way, but Prime on a big screen with a lot of good sound is pretty cool.
So good. All right. One other thing I want to talk about. I've got so many other things, but I know we're running short on time here. You actually ran for governor. You ran for the governor of Oregon.
Yeah.
2018.
Yeah.
You ran in the primary for governor. You didn't win, but Greg, what did you learn?
Oh, I learned it. There are so many people that need to be represented in an area, in a state, in a country that don't get a voice. And even as a candidate, I was able to bring their ability to voice their concerns and weave way they felt into what I would do going forward were I elected, and being able to share that in the competition, in the election process, to share those thoughts and the needs and wants of people other than the vast majority here in Oregon, and represent folks the right way. So I learned that, you know, and you learn the mechanics of a race. And of course, we all know what kind of know what those are, but they're tough. Yeah. It's a tough world running for office. It really is. Mm-hmm. But I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I wanted to change the dialogue, and I wanted to go back to something I learned on the blues that just quickly about policy. People come in and say, let's drain the swamp. Well, my idea was it's not a swamp. It's that area in government is filled with really good people. They just need to be led. No clear expectations, clearly know what was expected of them, and they will do great. And then again, like we talked about leadership, earning trust and being humble with them, being vulnerable. And yes. That's what I learned and try to carry forward. And unfortunately, I didn't win.
Yes. Oh, but you know what? I bet you changed some minds, and even like you said, like getting voices that were not typically heard. Right. Yes. I think that's so, yeah. Don't discount what you were able to do, Greg, in that. Well, this is called Something Extra.
Yeah.
What do you believe is the something extra that every leader needs?
Well, I'll go back to trust, first of all, but you need to be confident and at the same time be humble. Mm-hmm. Allow yourself to be vulnerable. There's so many words that go into leadership, but you have to weave them together and know what intensity each of those things, how it appears and how it's brought to the surface in your leadership style. And as a leader, don't try to be somebody you're not. You know, I always loved leaders that could tell a good joke. Well, I can't tell a joke worth beans, you know, so that wasn't going to go in my leadership toolbox, right?
No, just be your authentic self. Your authentic,
beautiful. That's it. Mm-hmm. And then earn the trust.
Yeah, that's so good. Well, when are you coming to St. Louis? You need to come to St. Louis.
I come every summer to work with the Red Tail Cadets, which is a great program, an offspring of the Tuskegee Airmen. Because they were the Red Tails, right? They had their own.
Yes.
It was the first African-American black squadron in World War II. And they did great. And they gave underprivileged youngsters a chance to do some pretty spectacular things. And now that's what they do that in St. Louis. Brennan Mann, you know him, he brought me into that. And so I come back every summer to talk to those high school kids that are learning how to fly. That's a great program. Great.
Yeah.
So I'll be back.
I remember. You got to let us know. Okay. You got to let us know, Greg. Okay. Well, this has been such a pleasure for me. Thank you so much for making the time. I'm so excited, truly, about just continuing our relationship, because I think we're going to do some other things together.
Thank you, Lisa. And congratulations on your book.
Thank you. Thank you. Somethingextrabook.com.
Oh man, it's going to be great. I haven't gotten it yet, but I'm looking forward to it. Congrats.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, have a great rest of the day.
Thank you. You too. Take care. Glad to be here.
Thank you for listening to today's show. Something Extra with Lisa Nichols is a Technology Partners production. Copyright Technology Partners, Inc., 2019. For show notes or to reach Lisa, visit tpi.co/podcast. Don't forget to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you listen.